Explicit content is found in this episode, so listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. This past week, I was tweeting about this episode. I mentioned how I had no knowledge of this case and that it would be really interesting to research. Then, as I was reading over some of my research documents, a name stuck out to me. A name I hadn't heard since 2003. Christy Proctor. This was the little girl that was snatched on her way home from a friend's house in North Dallas, a neighborhood just a few miles away from where I grew up. This little girl's disappearance would be what my mother and grandmother used to warn me about strangers. They were ready and willing to snatch me up, waiting on the street corner if I dared go outside unattended or go somewhere without my big brothers. This has caused an insane amount of paranoia in my life, and I'm not entirely sure I will ever get over it. And now, I know who to blame. Okay, on to the show. David Elliott Penton was every parent's worst nightmare. He was a stealthy predator who hid in broad daylight while stalking their children, watching them from afar as they walked home or played in their front yard. When David was around, no child was safe. Three sets of parents in the North Dallas area would soon learn this terrible lesson. He was born February 9, 1958, in Columbus, Ohio. Raised by a single mother after his father left for work one day and decided to never come back home again. He was the oldest with a younger sister who didn't receive the same attention from their mother as he did. When David was 6 months old, he was ejected from his mother's vehicle after a car accident. He was in a coma for several weeks, but his recovery was slow. His mother doted on him. And as he grew up, he made progress and became a star student. However, after entering high school, his grades and attendance began to slip. His family noticed a change in his personality. He could flip like a switch. One moment, he would be happy and calm, and the next, he would be agitated and become abusive, especially towards his younger sister. He dropped out of high school when he was 17 years old to join the Army. After basic training, he was stationed in Fort Hood by Killeen, Texas. He married a young woman by the name of Catherine, who had a child from a previous relationship and one child with David. David's change in behavior continued to escalate into vicious acts of abuse towards Catherine and their children. They divorced in 1979 when she learned that he had not only began to molest her eldest daughter, but their infant daughter as well. He would remarry a Korean national named Kyung in 1980 while stationed in Korea. They would have two children, a daughter and a son. David's troubles began to publicly surface on the day he violently shook his two-month-old son, Michael, because he would not stop crying. Kyung would divorce him shortly after this incident. In May of 1985, he was discharged from the Army after pleading guilty to manslaughter. He was granted a delayed sentence and posted bail. He would become a fugitive after failing to reappear for his sentencing. David drove his white van with distinctive brown stripes north towards Dallas. This van carried a monster who would commit unspeakable horrors to three beautiful, lively, and innocent little girls. January 19, 1985, Mesquite, Texas. 5-year-old Christy Meeks was rollerblading on the sidewalk and playing hide-and-seek outside of her apartment with her friend Tiffany Easter and brother Michael Meeks Jr. They were enjoying the crisp air and independence. They did not expect what was going to happen next. A tall Caucasian man approached them. He was unshaven, with medium-length brown shabby hair and bangs. He asked them if they would like some cookies. There were some in his car if they did. Tiffany, who was 9 at the time, had been warned about strangers and knew that this was not a good sign. Attempting to redirect her younger friends, she shared that she too had cookies at her house. Christy's brother Michael would follow her towards the apartment, but Christy stayed behind. Eventually, the stranger would put her in his trunk. And as he was driving to where he would eventually rape and murder Christy, he was pulled over by Mesquite police. He was charming and cordial and was allowed to continue towards his destination. He crossed state lines into Oklahoma and arrived at Lake Texoma. He found a remote area that allowed him to carry out his sadistic acts without interruption. He would remove her from the trunk of his car and rape her. Christy began to cry out and he strangled her. The thirst he felt had only been quenched momentarily. If she hadn't screamed so much, he could enjoy her much longer. David tried to quench his thirst with just one victim, but knew that it was impossible. He enjoyed it too much. He used to spend his days in Ohio with his sister's husband, driving around after work, parking by nearby elementary schools, and talking about the children he would like to take. He would leave Christy in her jeans, Color Me the Rainbow t-shirt, and Cabbage Patch shoes. He collected himself and made sure there were no traces of himself anywhere near the girl. He was meticulous in his cleanup. He left her. Her body lay there for 3 months, decomposing and being swept away by the cold Lake Texoma waters. On April 3rd, 1985, some fishermen came across a large dead bird floating in the water. Intrigued by the sight, they continued to get their boat closer. As they inched closer to the bird, they realized it was the body of a young child. They initially thought the body was that of a young boy, but when the body was transported to the medical examiner's office, it became clear that it was the body of a young girl. The level of decomposition made it impossible to determine the cause of death. Dental records confirm that the remains were that of 5-year-old Christy Meeks. Detectives had been working around the clock trying to follow any leads, but weren't able to find anything that led to her killer. He was parked by Dobie Primary on Waterfall Way in North Dallas when he spotted 10-year-old Tiffany Ibarra as she was walking back to school from changing her clothes at home. A bird had pooped on her shirt only a few minutes after she left the house, and she needed to go back home and change. She was dark-complected, but her mother was Caucasian and her father was Hispanic. David liked these types of victims. He considered Hispanic, Black, and Asian children to be the best victims, especially if they were from poor or low-income neighborhoods. They were throwaway children. No one would actually miss them. He watched as Tiffany continued to get closer and closer to his van. He waited when she was mere feet away from his door. He quickly exited his van and smiled. Tiffany felt that she needed to run as soon as she saw his menacing smile. She turned and began to run in the opposite direction, but David reached out and grabbed her by the backpack. He soon had her in a bear hug and shoved her into his van. He closed the door behind him. He couldn't wait to get her to the wooded area he had scoped out a few days prior. It was perfectly secluded. He could do what he wanted to her without anyone hearing or seeing them. He could murder her and leave her there. Who knows if anyone would find her? He didn't care. He just kept moving. He looked her up and down, and something changed. Maybe she wasn't exactly what he wanted that day. He asked her for her home number. Shakily, she shared her number. He pulled out his bag phone, which was an earlier version of a cell phone, and handed it to her after dialing the number. He told her, "Tell your mom that you've been kidnapped." Tiffany's mother picked up the phone and heard her daughter quickly tell her that she had been taken. The line went dead. David took the phone and hung it up as soon as she finished her sentence. Tiffany's mother became miffed. How dare Tiffany play this joke on her? It wasn't funny. If she was trying to get out of school, this was not the way to do it. She was putting on her shoes as her daughter ran into their home in tears. She sobbed and told her mother of the stranger, who took her into his van, made her call her, and then told her, "You better not walk to school alone again. I've been watching you, and next time, I won't let you go." He followed her all the way to her home and sped off as soon as she reached the apartment driveway. Tiffany's mother became concerned and took her daughter and drove around the neighborhood searching for her white van. When their search turned up nothing, they went to Dobie Primary and informed the principal, who then called the Dallas Police Department. The police arrived and took statements from Tiffany and her mother. They didn't pay much attention to their statements, nor did they attempt to patrol the area in the event the predator returned. After all, Tiffany hadn't been taken. He did return to Waterfall Way. On February 15, 1986, he was waiting for his next victim. He found her in 9-year-old Christy Proctor. She was wearing a pink and white sweater, blue jeans, and white tennis shoes. She was just leaving her friend's house, carrying a heart-shaped plastic box given to her by her grandmother. She had enjoyed her time with her friend, but it was time to make her way home. She walked down Waterfall Way, just like she had many times before. This was the route to her school, Dobie Primary. He exited his vehicle, much like he did 3 days prior. He wasn't going to let this one get away. He took Christy and drove to a South Plano field where he raped and strangled her. He left her, just like he did Christy Meeks, discarded, like garbage. Dallas police connected the dots after Christy Proctor's abduction. There was a predator looking for children around Dobie Primary. They returned to get a description of the man who took Tiffany. She said he was a young Caucasian male with dark hair and a mustache, and a large mole on the right side of his face. With this description, they released the composite sketch, but none of the leads led to Christy's abductor or to Christy. November 3rd, 1987. 3.5-year-old Roxanne Reyes and her 6-year-old friend Julia Diaz were supposed to stay close to their apartments. The neighborhood in Garland, Texas, where she was being raised by her mother Tammy and father Sergio, was not an easy place to live. It was rampant with drugs and prostitution. Tammy was working hard to give Roxanne a better life. She thought Roxanne would be safe playing with a friend outside. She didn't expect that a man with evil intentions would be lurking down the alley after scoping out the nearby elementary school. Roxanne and Julia spotted a field across the street where wildflowers were in full bloom. They walked across and began collecting flowers for their mothers. The man in his car watched as they collected bunches of flowers. He was eyeing Julia. She was exactly what he liked. Dark complected, dark hair, and a true throwaway kid. Look at this neighborhood. No one would miss her. He pulled up beside them and got out of his car. Roxanne, distracted by the flowers, didn't notice the stranger approaching them. Julia turned and saw the man smiling. He said, "I have some candy for you." Julia told Roxanne, who had just turned to see who was offering candy, that he was lying. David quickly lunged towards her, but was unable to grab her. Julia ran back across the street to the apartments, attempting to get away from her potential abductor. David chased Julia across the street, but she was able to squeeze through a narrow opening between the buildings. He attempted to cut her off and circled the building, but he ran into a resident. They locked eyes, and he ran back to his car. He barely noticed her as he was approaching the vehicle. There was Roxanne, waiting by his car. Maybe she didn't understand why Julia left her. Maybe she was waiting for candy. He approached Roxanne and punched her in the stomach. He did this to knock the wind out of her, so she could not scream as he threw her in the car and sped off. Frightened, and eventually confused, Roxanne cried. Julia ran to the apartment management office where Roxanne's mother worked. Unable to find her, she found an adult and told them what happened. By the time Roxanne's parents were informed, it would be too late for her. She was already on her way to death. Garland police responded to a call for help and created a composite sketch of the abductor based on Julia's description. The flyer was distributed by neighbors and family as they began to canvass the neighborhood. They were searching for the van and of the man that Julia saw that day. David took Roxanne to a remote field in Murphy, Texas, just 15 miles from her home. He would rape her multiple times and then strangle her. He noticed that the field was fenced off in certain areas, so he carried her lifeless body across the field and threw her over the fence. He applauded his stealth. Thus far, no one was on to him. He confused police every time he crossed jurisdictions. And after Roxanne's murder, he was done with Texas. He moved back to Ohio. March 30th, 1988. 9-year-old Nitra Ross was visiting the Columbus, Ohio home of her aunt and uncle. She met David that day when he was visiting her uncle and smoking crack with him. He was a co-worker and Nitra had no reason to be concerned. The next day, on the 31st, David again stopped by. This time, he struck up a conversation with Nitra, and when her uncle wasn't looking, forced Nitra into his van. He had scouted the perfect location, and he couldn't wait to carry out his evil deeds there. He knew that the spot was secluded, and also knew that Nitra was not familiar with the area, as she was from Dayton, Ohio. She would have no idea where he was taking her. He arrived in Waldo, Ohio, where he took a small dirt road to a heavily wooded creek. He raped and strangled Nitra. Nitra bled on the carpet of his van, but he was satisfied that he could clean this up. He was so good about cleaning up before, and this was no different. He pulled her limp body from the van and threw her into the brush. He didn't have a care in the world. He was so happy and satisfied. Nitra would be left just like all the others, alone. Nitra's uncle reported her missing, and an immediate search of the area was launched. David, being a concerned co-worker and wanting to show his support, arrived to help with the search for Nitra. However, Nitra's uncle did share with police that the last person to see her alive was David. She was speaking to him right before her uncle went back inside. Police questioned David and asked to search his vehicle. He agreed. Upon inspecting the van, they pulled up the carpet, and they found a bloodstain that was pooling underneath the passenger seat. DNA testing was still in its infancy and not readily available to most counties. This was the case for Marion County. David wasn't immediately arrested for her abduction. Her body hadn't been discovered, so they weren't even sure if she was dead. They continued their search for Nitra and began their investigation into David Elliott Penton. April 1988. Back in Texas, an old bird mattress covered the remains of Christy Proctor. After 2 years, she was finally able to go home. Her remains were discovered in that South Plano field. Plano happens to be my hometown, and 6 miles from where Christy was abducted. An autopsy revealed that she was strangled and likely sexually assaulted. About the same time, David was being arrested for Nitra's abduction. May 19th, 1988. Roxanne's remains were discovered in Murphy, Texas. Her autopsy revealed that she had also been raped and strangled. The loss of Roxanne destroyed Sergio and Tammy's marriage, and for many years after Sergio moved to Mexico, Tammy believed that he had Roxanne. Despite her hesitation, Tammy held a funeral for Roxanne, but continued to refute that her daughter's remains were in the casket. September 27, 1988. A hunter stumbled upon human remains. He contacted the Marion County Sheriff's Department and reported what he had found. The remains were transported to the ME's office, and initial testing revealed that the remains were that of a 9 to 11-year-old African-American girl. Bone marrow was extracted from the bones and compared with the blood of Nydra's mother, Wonder. In January of 1989, the results returned as a positive match. The remains were indeed that of Nydra Ross. But due to the level of decomposition, the medical examiner could not determine conclusively the manner of death, but stated that since they found no evidence that the girl had been stabbed or shot, that she was most likely strangled to death. On May 11, 1990, David was indicted by a grand jury for aggravated kidnapping and murder. The death penalty was now on the table, and the years that David had eluded police was now quickly coming to an end. The connection between his Texas crimes and Nydra's murder would be linked by an unlikely source. Roxanne's maternal grandparents were from Ohio. Despite the distance, they too felt the loss of Roxanne. Her grandfather, Paul, was on his way back to his home in Minford, Ohio, when he stopped in Columbus to fuel up. He had seen the composite sketch that was distributed in Roxanne's neighborhood. He hung up plenty to recognize the face that was staring back at him in the Marion Star newspaper. The photograph seemed to show the same man who Julia saw that day. He picked up the paper and read the story. David Elliott Penton was a fugitive from Texas. He had been sentenced to 5 years in prison for the death of his infant son, Michael. He was being held in the county jail on charges related to the kidnapping and murder of Nydra Ross. Paul found the Columbus Police Department and asked to speak with the investigators on the Nydra Ross case. He had information that might help. Investigators met with Paul and discovered that there were three children whose murders remained unsolved, including Roxanne's. The composite sketch matched very closely with the photograph of David Penton that was featured in the Marion Star. The one thing that all witnesses mentioned was that the abductor had a mole above his right eye. David's booking photo would reveal a similar marking. Detectives in Garland, Texas were informed in 1991 of a possible connection between David and the three murders. They announced that they were investigating the connection between Penton and the murder of Roxanne Reyes. David's trial began in April of 1991. Despite the circumstantial and physical evidence they had on David, prosecutors also had jail informants who would testify that they were incarcerated with David and that he often bragged about his crimes. Two different informants testified that David shared with them the details of Nydra's murder. He had somehow lured her into his van and attempted to have sex with her. Accounts differ on if he was successful, but they agree that he strangled her and dumped her in that Waldo, Ohio creek. Catherine and Keong were also called to testify. They both confirmed that David had molested their children and that he was a predator. He was found guilty of aggravated murder and kidnapping and sentenced to 30 years to life. Nydra's mother, Wonder Ross, was pleased about the verdict. She told the Marion Star, "I'm very happy about it. Now he won't be able to hurt anybody else's child." Despite stating in 1991 that the Garland PD was looking into Roxanne's case, no action was taken. It wasn't until June of 2000 when a Fort Worth detective named Diane Teft contacted Garland PD detective Gary Sweet. She stated that an Ohio inmate by the name of Jeffrey Sunnycab contacted her regarding a 1983 case she was investigating. She received another letter from Sunnycab, who had been sharing a cell with David Elliott Penton. He offered that he had more information regarding the death of Roxanne Reyes. Detective Sweet began corresponding with Jeffrey Sunnycab. He asked him what details David may have shared with him. Sunnycab stated that David abducted Roxanne from a field and that he bragged about keeping her in his van for 3 days. David owned two vehicles at the time, a Datsun, which he used to abduct Roxanne, and the van, which he used to take her body to that Murphy field. Sunnycab stated that Roxanne was wearing a purple top and pink shorts, information which at the time had not been released to the public. He mentioned two other girls, Christy Meeks and Christy Proctor. David had told them about their murders and often tried to sidetrack conversations just so he could boast about them. He loved reliving them, Sunnycab said. He treated them as normal conversations with men who were convicted of similar crimes. Detective Sweet knew exactly who Jeffrey Sunnycab was. He was a pedophile. Looking into his background, you will see that he was accused and convicted of 4 counts of rape and 1 count of corrupting another with drugs. Specifically, he was incarcerated for purchasing an 8-year-old girl from her parents. The price? A pack of beer and a carton of cigarettes. He brought her to his mobile home and had the young girl scrawl her name, identifying herself as the bride and Sunnycab as her groom on a marriage certificate he printed off the internet. She was now his wife. He was arrested and convicted for sexual assault on a minor, but only served a small amount of time before he was released. When he was released, he sought out his victim again, and her parents allowed her to return to his home. He pleaded guilty to avoid a trial because he cared for his young wife. What is clear is why Sunnycab reached out to Detective Teft. He was sentenced to 20 years for the rape of the young girl, and it was unlikely that he would get a reduced sentence, but perhaps it was worth a try to Sunnycab. He wanted letters written to judges and prosecutors to inform them of how instrumental he had been in this case. Detective Sweet knew Penton was eligible for parole in 2027, which would make him just 69 years old. He would be more than capable of continuing to commit crimes against children. He heard from Sunnycab that whenever young girls popped up on the TV, Penton would say, "She better be glad I'm in here." And that instead of punching her in the stomach like he had done in the past, he would use a stun gun. He wanted to improve so that it would be easier to collect his victims. An FBI profiler assessed David Penton and found him to be a sexual sadist with an above-average IQ. His behavior as a murderer would be assessed as neat, methodical, and premeditated. He acts alone, and he will not share. He would also take victims to a secluded area where he could repeatedly sexually abuse them and use methods that leave the least physical evidence. In this case, strangulation and suffocation. Then he would dispose of the body in a pre-planned place. He would carefully and methodically get rid of the body and evidence and cover his tracks. Detective Sweet discovered through Sunnycab that David kept a photo album in his cell. In it were pictures of young children with the letters V, O, or A written on the back of them. When asked what these letters meant, Jeffrey explained that they stood for what kind of sex David had with them. Detective Sweet contacted prison officials and asked that they collect the photo album. Inside of the photo album were also pictures of David's car and van. They were shown to Julia Diaz and Tiffany Ibarra, and they confirmed that these were the vehicles they saw on the date of their attempted abduction. Tiffany also identified David from a photographic lineup. David was aware that detectives in Texas were interested in tying him to the murders of the three young girls. In fact, despite bragging for years over the murders, once he learned of the investigation, he said everything he had said was a lie and that he would never hurt a child. Detective Sweet wanted to introduce himself properly to David Penton. Once Penton realized who the detective was, he peed his pants. He attempted to conceal how his body had betrayed him, but was unsuccessful. He was questioned by Sweet for hours, but denied any involvement in the deaths of the three little girls in Texas. However, he would make several incriminating statements, such as, "You can't have anything but circumstantial evidence. I'm not stupid. I didn't leave any evidence." In August of 2003, David was extradited to Collin County, Texas, to stand trial for the murders of Christy Meeks, Christy Proctor, and Roxanne Reyes. In order to avoid the death penalty, the defense offered a guilty plea on all three counts for life without the possibility of parole. Despite snuffing out the life of four innocent young victims and possibly more, David didn't want his snuffed out by the state of Texas. The prosecution accepted the offer without the approval of the families. The family of Christy Meeks, in particular, was not happy with this outcome. Her father, Mike, told the Dallas Morning News, "For 18 months, I've been told this man was going to die. I was told from day one that this was a death penalty case. They're taking the easy way out, in my opinion." Tammy Lopez was the only one to provide a victim impact statement. She later shared with the Dallas Morning News, "He killed our children, but he also killed us. He destroyed their lives, and he also destroyed our lives, and we're the ones paying. I know he's not going to go through the pain my daughter went through, but he is going to go through pain." Despite the three cases being closed, there was no real closure for the families of the victims or the potential victims. They began sharing their stories in the Dallas Morning News. "I was 16 when David was brought to Texas, and the stories of the potential victims that started popping up in the newspapers terrified me. I heard about where Christy Proctor's body had been found. It was in a field that was only southwest from the East Plano neighborhood I grew up in. The monster that so many children feared, including me, was coming back to face the music. Some couldn't handle that." Tiffany Ibarra would die of a drug overdose in 2011. Despite being spared the fate that her classmate, Christy Proctor, faced, she was plagued by David's actions. She had survivor's guilt. If David had taken her, would he have taken Christy? The answer was too unbearable for her, and she succumbed to the addiction. Tammy Lopez passed away in 2013 due to natural causes related to her poor health. She was never the same after David Elliott Penton killed her little girl. She would hold on to the grief until her death. David is incarcerated in the Toledo Correctional Institution. His first parole hearing is in March of 2027, when he will be 69 years old. If David is granted parole or is released from his sentence, he will be extradited to Texas, where he will serve out his life sentence where there is no possibility of parole. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review on iTunes. It would really help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. While you're waiting for episode 4, here are some other great true crime podcasts you can listen to. Once Upon a Crime, the podcast for the true crime addict. Join host Esther Ludlow for each episode as she dives into some of the most fascinating true crime cases, told one chapter at a time. Bone Palace Ballet Podcast. Join host Amity and Jamie as they parse their collective fascination with true crime, murders, vanishings, and the macabre. And last but not least, True Crime Review, an unflinching gaze into the depths of human depravity, written, produced, and hosted by Joe Ross. Until next time.